Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Reda Elhaj, global top scientist who is sharing his deep insights and special tips. Reda, thank you for sharing your many considerable experiences with our audience.
Thank you, Stephen, for giving me this opportunity to express my thoughts related to various aspects of computer science and our contributions to the field. Actually, running a large group of over 15 graduate students is not an easy task. Fortunately, most of my students are receiving major prestigious awards from the government of Alberta and from NSERC. Here, I would like to thank Alberta Innovate for their support to many of my students that really helped me attracting potential stars to come and join my research group at the University of Calgary, and many of them have been participating in the Imaging Cup.
Now, Reda, I've looked at your background, and just you have an amazing background. So can you profile some of your top research successes and then the value that they provide to research and the implications and applications to broader business in the ICT industry?
Thank you for raising this question. We have several contributions that have been well received by the research community and the industry. We are working on a diverse number of research topics. We are closely working with several companies to transfer our research contributions to the industry. We are mainly focusing on health informatics, computational biology, big data management and analysis, social media analysis, and many applications of these. We are working on theory and applications. You may be aware that big data is being a buzzword these days, and data is being collected these days at a very high rate. And it's important to store and analyze the data so that we can maximize the benefit by valuable knowledge discovery leading to effective decision making. In the health informatics field, we are focusing on the Canadian healthcare system, which is a unique system, has two levels of doctors, the general practitioners and the specialists. We are working on a referral process which will make it easier for patients and specialists to meet faster. You know that there's a long wait time, which everybody is suffering from. We have a prototype forum-based approach where the office of a general practitioner would post a case to be seen by a specialist. Then specialists in the area specific to the patient may get the case based on various factors, their expertise dealing with similar cases, their fit to the preferences of the patient, like time, distance, how serious is the case, and so on and so forth. But we try to keep the overload balance between the specialists. This is expected to work fine if most of the specialists will agree to join the forum and invest time tracking the posted referrals. But unfortunately, many specialists are overloaded and they don't have time to do things other than their own job. So thinking that they are very busy most of the time, and this is a reason for the delay in the appointment. Maybe sometimes it takes more than 6 months, as I said, for a patient to be seen by a specialist. So we developed a prototype that collects data about successful and unsuccessful referrals. This data is well analyzed together with the preferences of the patient. As I mentioned above, I want to wait longer or I cannot wait. How far from my house I want the specialist to be? Can I drive, let's say, to another location far away from my house, or I need it close to my house? Should I take the bus or whatever? Then the general practitioner may contact the specialist in order to find someone accepting the case. Another interesting component of our work related to health is helping in identifying disease biomarkers. This is an important work because we are trying to tackle cases related to severe diseases like cancer. We closely work with collaborators from the School of Medicine. They do some lab experiments to compare infected tissues and non-infected tissues from cancer patients and normal people, for example. So they collect the tissues, analyze them, and try to get the data. They produce huge amounts of data reflecting the expression levels of various molecules like genes, proteins in the tissues. Our task is to analyze the data and identify the minimum number of molecules that could be potential for further investigation as biomarkers for the cancer, and hence any treatment should only concentrate on them. Our collaborators take our findings to further analyze only the genes specified in the outcome of our study. So instead of analyzing thousands of genes, which is very costly, so we try to minimize. Sometimes we could get 2-3 genes that should be targeted, and this would lead, of course, to huge saving in terms of time, effort, and money. So we have concentrated on social media analysis and social network analysis for several targets. For example, one of our clients advertised a new service, and they want to know how it is received by the customer and what is the impact of that, and how they should react to the impact. So we found some interesting results by analyzing the social media, and we reflected that most of the customers were not aware of an important piece of information that was included as part of the text in the posted ad by the client. Then the client realized that, and they re-advertised by highlighting that piece of information which were very important. And then based on that, most of the customers were able to see that piece of information, and the new ad was well received, way better than before, and they had high impact as targeted by the client. So we are also working on opinion mining and propagation of influence, with emphasis on identifying spam reviewers for products. As you may know, that social media and social network platforms have introduced a new trend in marketing. Now it is the commercials on the TV are not the only way of advertising. Many clients and many producers are trying to advertise on the web, and so posting online reviews of products is a very common trend that is rapidly receiving population. And popularity is very important for marketing on the web. So we are using social network analysis combined with data mining and machine learning techniques to identify important fellows among those who post reviews, because some of them are influential and some of them are not. Some of them are affected by others. So we try to find how the trend is changing with new posts over time and who is influencing other reviewers negatively or positively. Are there any fake, unreal, or spam reviews that are solely added to influence the general mode in one direction or the other? It is important also to identify and separate these spam reviews to avoid their negative influence, whether in favor of the product or against the product, because some companies may try to influence the customers against competitive products or in favor of their own products. So these spam reviews should be identified and highlighted, and try to delete them in order not to influence reviewers in the wrong direction. So this is a very interesting and difficult area which has attracted the attention in academia and industry, and there is not much progress in this. We have done some work, and we have contributed something, but we are still working on this, and we think that we still have many things to be done in order to get a comprehensive system. Some of my students are working on this. And as you see, all these applications require dealing with a huge amount of data. And this leads me to describe some of our techniques for handling big data. We realize that the amount of data available is growing way faster than the growth in the computing power. Daily used computers have limited capabilities, as you know. So when it comes to data analysis, the capabilities of daily computers are limited, and they can only analyze limited amounts of data. So we developed a technique that allows a normal computer that is daily used in the office or at home to analyze a huge data set by using only limited resources. For this, we re-implemented major parts of the operating system to handle the management of the data structures required to analyze the data. And instead of limiting ourselves to the main memory, we expand to the disk whenever necessary. So the upper limit for our analysis becomes the size of the available disk space rather than the size of the available memory. This allows us to analyze huge gene expression data, social media data, time series data for weather forecasting, stock market analysis, forex analysis, retail stores, tax documents, open source intelligence. We are dealing with a number of clients who are very happy with our findings in these areas. I hope I have covered most of the things that are interesting in this.
You know, that's fascinating what you just described, and it kind of reminds me of some of the work that Judea Pearl has done. And I'm not sure if you looked at some of his work on external validity, but also on a sort of causal inference, causal relationships, and how he's created extensions to math to be able to represent that, those kinds of causal relationships. And what he's, because you can express it mathematically, what happens is you can do more definitive analysis, and you can also create algorithms out of it and put it into a computer. Have you looked at any of his work at all?
Yes, I have seen some of his work, but our work is somehow different, and we try to take it in a different trend. That is, we try to be more concentrating on the prediction rather than the causality. So we try, for example, to predict how the future trend in the stock market will be based on the current status and the external influence like the news and the media.
Now, you've got this amazing background, as I indicated, and you also have top leadership roles. Can you talk about some of these top leadership roles and the value they provide to research and the implications to the broader business and ICT industry?
Actually, as I mentioned before, I run a large research group of over 15 graduate students. So managing this group is very demanding, but I am happy that I have a group of highly qualified and talented students. And of course, this requires considerable time and effort. I schedule traveling to work with my collaborators, mostly in the Middle East and Europe, where I can find excellent students who only need motivation and the necessary resources to excel. So as you know, in the Middle East, they have limited resources. I find students who have the potential, but they are not able to produce there because they don't have the environment required for them to produce. So I work with the students before they apply to officially join my group. I want to make sure that they really meet my expectations and the high standards within the group. I expect and mentor the students hard to keep them productive. I convince them to work hard to maintain high standards so that they can come here and work with my other students and raise their level to the standard that I want. So this way they help with part of my load and gain wonderful experience as future independent researchers who are expected to lead their own research groups to success. This model is highly successful, and I have been applying this model for years, and every year I get it improved and advanced. I even get undergrad students in my senior level courses involved in some research activities and get my graduate students to mentor them. This engagement helps undergraduate students a lot in building their research skills and vision. They learn how to combine research with development. Actually, this is a very essential characteristic these days because positions in the industry, in the market, are no more only concentrating on development. So we are shifting into a new era where development requires combining research with skills in development. So students, even with PS degree, are expected to be more creative and innovative in their development rather than doing systematic routine work. I emphasize on this and highlight this to my students that they must build their own distinguished skills that will make them unique in their job environment. I am happy that my students are employed by leading organizations like Microsoft, Google, Teradata, Oracle, and others. When I met one of the managers, for example, of one of these organizations, the first thing he said was, "Thank you for sending this wonderful student to us. He is doing great." So I was very happy to hear this. I expect my students to work at high standards and to be always successful and achieve what the others could not, or at least be in the leading group. I work hard with my students. I expect them to work as hard as I do, at least. I tell them that each one of you has his own work, but I have to follow up with all of you to know what you are doing with your own work. So imagine my load and don't think that you have high load. So this motivates them to work harder and long hours. My students are receiving the top scholarships in the country. I have more than 80% of my students receiving external scholarships. I am the only professor maybe in Canada coast to coast who has mentored 3 students who have received the most prestigious NSERC Vanier scholarship. And in Alberta, they offer the Alberta Innovate scholarship for students. And I have one of the largest number of students receiving the scholarship from Alberta Innovate. As said, the opportunity to receive such scholarships and the success of my existing students in receiving such scholarships motivate other students to work hard to catch up and target these scholarships. Actually, every year I turn down a large number of applicants from all over the world because I have more applicants who I know than those who I don't know, because I don't want to bring here a black box and then get surprised. I prefer to bring students who I know and I meet and I mentor before they officially apply to join my group, so there will be no risk in bringing them to Calgary. As I said, I prefer them over bringing someone who I never met and I don't know anything about them, whether the applicant will be successful, whether his application reflects his real potential or not. So I hope I will continue to have the opportunity to bring such successful and wonderful, hardworking students to Calgary.
Greta, you've done an amazing job with your students and also with your own research, and you're renowned for that. What's a particular also of interest is that you've been able to engage your students into the, let's say, the DreamSpark program, the BizTalk or BizSpark program, Microsoft, and specifically now targeting something called the Imagine Cup. So from your perspective, why should faculty and students get involved in the Imagine Cup? Because your university has been so successful with this venue, and especially under your tutelage.
Thank you for raising this question. Actually, the Imagine Cup is a unique opportunity for faculty and students to get engaged in real international competition. As you may know, that it is like the Olympic Games of computing and development. By participating in such competition, students learn how to develop their real professional skills. They have to think outside the box in an innovative way. They learn how to turn their ideas into some useful product that could benefit the humanity. They learn how to be self-dependent, which is very important for the students to build their self-confidence, trusting their own capabilities and potential. While doing research projects for their thesis work, whether PhD or MSc, students mainly do things that are part of an existing project. They only have to think of a novel solution or methodology to complement the work by others. Many thesis work, whether PhD or MSc, are reflecting incremental contributions to the research. You take an existing problem, you try to solve the existing problem in a way nobody else thought of. But for the Imagine Cup, the way of producing new ideas and realizing them is very challenging. It needs a lot of brainstorming and then finding out if somebody has the same idea before. Has this idea been raised in the research or industry before? To make sure that it is a unique idea which will have the potential to win the local competition in the first stage, because we have to win the local competition to qualify for the finals. Then going to the finals is by itself a unique experience. Actually, this year, Microsoft has introduced 2 levels of elimination. After the local competition, they do a semifinals where they eliminate another stage, and then only the best teams will go to the final, whether they are representing every country in the world or only few countries. So we will get into more challenging competition this year. So when we pass the local finals, we have to go to the semifinals this year, and then if we pass the semifinals, we have to go to the finals. Then competing with all talents from around the world in the final is really very stressful and reveals the real skills and quality of the team. When I say my students are among the best, I mean that I am comparing within Calgary or within Alberta or within Canada or North America or worldwide? I cannot specify, because I have to specify the comparison group. But without the success in the Imagine Cup, people may not trust me that my students are among the best in the world, because they may find my statement strange or even offending. But when I succeed in the Imagine Cup, I can state this and stress this. So after winning the world finals in the Imagine Cup, I can proudly state that my students are among the best worldwide, which is really a great honor and pleasure. But this brings in responsibilities to work harder to keep the momentum, as we are more closely watched now and everybody is trying to see whether the success was by chance or it is to continue in the coming years. So this year we started to work earlier for next year. We tried to get more challenging ideas in order to make sure that we will pass the local and the semifinals so that we qualify to the finals that will be held in Seattle in July 2014.
And I guess what's particularly useful, which I described in my question, is that Microsoft has like their DreamSpark program where students have access to all of this software tools and server tools and other kinds of products and services that Microsoft has, or they have the BizSpark program for those who perhaps have a more of an entrepreneurial bent. And there's a great ecosystem to support all of the work you've done. And as a result, it's taken your students to the worlds and then been able to achieve success. And of course, this also speaks to you and the work that you've done. Now, you described the fact that it's been a really interesting experience. So can you get into more detail about what it's like to be at the finals in Canada and then also in Russia?
Oh, you are right. Microsoft has all these programs that help students to get into the development and integrate development into research in an easy way. In the past, all these were to be paid for in order to be used, but now Microsoft is offering these for students and researchers free of charge, which is fascinating and attracts more interest in Microsoft products. So we have two teams from my research group who participated in Canadian competition last year. I was not aware of the very details of the rules that were applied by Microsoft last year, because they have three categories. We were thinking that they will select one representative from Canada from each of the three categories. So we had two teams, one under the citizenship and one under the innovation categories. I was hoping that both teams would qualify to the final, because I was confident that my students are doing novel work and have the capability and skills to complete the two projects successfully. I was even meeting students over Skype when I was traveling. We worked hard on both projects, thanks to Dr. John Rockney, who was registered as mentor for one team, and I was registered as mentor to the other team. And students attended all information sessions by Alberta Innovate. Here again, I would like to thank Alberta Innovate for the great effort they put in the competition. They were closely following up with the teams. They funded the competition locally, and they motivated the students all the time by following up. We submitted both projects to the local competition on time. We were not aware of the number of submissions, but we were told later on that there were over 700 submissions in Canada, which is a huge number. We were optimistic and waited for the initial screening outcome, which led to the announcement of the three finalists in the Canadian competition, one in each of the three categories, as I said, the games, the innovation, and the citizenship. We had two teams, one in innovation and one in citizenship, and we were extremely happy and excited that we had our two teams among the three Canadian finalists. When they informed us of the results, we really realized that our two teams will compete against each other, which was another challenge for us. But now our target was to have one of the two teams to represent Canada in the final and not to have both teams out of the competition, which would have looked bad. But it was a great pleasure and joyfulness to have one of our teams winning the first position in Canada. I was so happy on behalf of the students in the team that their effort was at the end well recognized. Then we realized that the new challenges and responsibilities waiting us. So winning the Canadian competition was the start of the real test if we want to be recognized and excel at the international arena. This is what I made clear for my students. We have to work hard to represent Canada in the finals the best way we could. Surprising that, though I am Canadian, members of the team are international students and live in Canada based on their issued study permit. So the international students representing Canada, and I was finding hard time issuing their visas and are arranging their trip to Russia. Thanks to Microsoft, they helped in this and we could get them to Russia. And the team worked hard for 2 months between the Canadian finals and the world finals to improve the project and to bring it to the level where it could well compete at the world final. So we arrived in Russia and the stress started when we saw the other teams all well prepared. We realized that it will be a tough competition. When we closely watched the details of the other projects in the competition, we anticipated that we will be one of the winning teams. We could read the success of our team in the eyes of the judges when they were trying to watch the different projects and analyze them and rank them. So then we had to go to the announcement ceremony. So sitting in the theater waiting for the results to be announced requires strong heart. Believe me, it was not easy. Within the group, we were used to achieve success and we wanted to leave the theater with success. So we started to think whether our first competition at the international arena will be successful or not. Will we return back to Canada with the award and share the joy and happiness with our fellow Canadians or not? I cannot imagine how we would have looked if we were not a winning team. I am happy that we were a winning team and we came back with the award.
Now, your students are looking in when they're doing their projects for interesting pieces of research. So I would imagine then that they're members, for example, of the Association for Computing Machinery, and they're using the digital library to look at background research and help in their research when they're doing their projects for the Imagine Cup. Is that so?
Yes, actually, my students spend long time on the computer trying to investigate the research of the others, download papers related to their research. Now, everything is available on the digital libraries of ACM, IEEE, Springer, Elsevier, and others. So my students try to analyze all these digital libraries for research outcomes that have been recently published and compare them with our research, what people have done and what have not been done. And when we get a new idea, the most important thing is that they spend long time analyzing the existing research, the latest published outcome, to realize that this is a new idea and never tackled before by other researchers. We get many ideas and then some of students get disappointed that they find that somebody has already started working on this. So though the solution would not be comprehensive, but it may not be accepted and were received by the Imagine Cup judges because it is an already thought of idea. So they spend a lot of time in front of the computer analyzing the existing research from the digital libraries. As you said, yes, you are right.
Well, it's interesting on the digital libraries. I actually spoke at the Economic Forum about innovation, and there's this sort of relationship between use of digital libraries and the ranking of universities, for example, or the use of digital libraries and the innovations that are coming out of government research labs or corporate research labs. In fact, all the major corporations, for example, use the ACM digital library. So it's kind of interesting that, in fact, to the audience, I would encourage use of digital libraries because they do help in innovation and in research. And what's happening with your team is good evidence. But also, you have this outstanding mentor and professor in you, and then, of course, you have your remarkable students. I guess this leads to my next question, then. From your special perspective as a supervising faculty and mentor, can you describe the top placing winning projects for the Imagine Cup and what made them special?
Our two projects ranked among the top three in Canada, as I mentioned. So we have two novel ideas, one for the innovation and one for the citizenship, as I said. One project called USAFE guides people towards optimizing their spending, time and fuel consumption, which is, of course, will help in saving the environment by less driving. So instead of driving long way to the retail store, you try to take a short drive to a nearby store so that you save the environment. And this is one of the objectives that we added to our analysis. So the basic idea of the project was to develop an application which gets the list of items from a person planning to purchase and then investigates the available retail stores to find the lowest overall total cost for all these items. So instead of getting one item on sale at one store, another item on sale at the other store, and driving around, wasting time and wasting fuel and spending on fuel and hurting the environment. So it's better to try to optimize the cost of the overall list of items you are targeting. You minimize your overall cost instead of going and purchasing one reduced item at one store and at that time purchase another at some other items at the same store and pay more than what you could pay at another store by looking at the whole list together. So our system checks the retail store's prices for all the items, try to find what is the minimum overall cost. It checks traffic conditions and provides the best route to reach the store. It's also possible to specify the preferences of the user, whether the user is very busy man and wants to save time, or the user wants to save money or gas, or and what is the priority I want to save on the cost and my time. So we try to have a multi-objective optimization process, and the system will produce the output based on the ranking of the objectives of the users. And we are trying to develop this further this year. I will not go into the details because still the students are working, and I don't want to disclose what are the new ideas that we have to add to this project in the new competition. And the second project was Sano, which is a healthcare-related system. Sano tracks the behavior of a person and his movement trend throughout the day. And this is very crucial for people who spend long time sitting in front of the computer or behind a desk in an office. So Sano keeps a record of the health indicator for the person registered in the system and his or her exercise plan. It warns the person when it is time for certain category of exercises like neck-related exercises, shoulder-related exercises, leg-related exercises, arm, whatever. So the system channel guides the user how to perform the exercises the best way possible. It has preloaded exercises in each of these categories, and you may also record some new exercises. Physiotherapist may record some exercises, and Sano captures all of these and allows the physiotherapist to help their patient by providing some programs to their customers without the need for the customers to go to the clinic. So Sano records the various movements of the user throughout the day and sends them to the physiotherapist, who may go for the other choice of watching remotely live the patient if they are in critical situation and they need to watch closely. They don't need to go to the clinic. They may be watched by the physiotherapist remotely and closely live using our system. So Sano also provides for competitions between different users using the system. Who is using the system better? Who is doing the exercises more correctly? Who is keeping his health indicators higher? So this has been an interesting competition between my students in the lab. They use Sano and they try to get fun of that. So Sano ranked the first in Canada and received the KFC Innovation Award in the World Finals in Russia. I am happy that we got two finalists in Canada and one award winner at the international arena. It is really a wonderful feeling that cannot be described with words. Really, it was a very, very, very wonderful feeling. And a person has to live the joy in order to understand how the real feeling looks like. It's really very, very different feeling.
Well, that's, again, just a remarkable what's been achieved. And a special congratulations to yourself and the students and the university for such an amazing achievement. Now, Retta, you are renowned for your expertise, so can you provide some special tips in your areas of expertise?
Oh, actually, the current era of computing no more allows for great achievements by those continuing to have a narrow vision within a specific area of research and insist on individual work. So it is important to go for group work that covers a variety of disciplines. So computing is a field that should serve all other disciplines, as you know, and the big question is how to adapt the various computing techniques to other disciplines. So everyone is trying to integrate some computing features into their work, whether in medicine, in finance, in business, in health, in education. So everyone is trying to adapt some computing techniques, and the basic question is how to adopt these best techniques to serve the various disciplines the best way. So it's important to talk to people and understand their problems in a correct and comprehensive way in order to tackle these problems and find specific, helpful, and working successful solutions for them. So, for example, social networks have been around for a long time. Since the beginning of the 20th century, people have been working on social networks. And if you look in the literature, most researchers attribute the start of social network research to Marino, who was a medical doctor and wanted to study the relationship between his patients in 1934. But he was doing manual analysis. But the recent booming in social network research is all due to the development of powerful computing techniques that are capable of analyzing large networks. Also, we have the development of social network platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and the others, highly influenced and motivated for the research in the area. It is required to find the holes, actually, and try to close them. So we should avoid repeating other research. We should avoid reinventing the wheel. So no one will accept a research that is kind of reinventing the wheel. So it is a waste of effort, time, and resources to try to do something that has been done and waste your time and effort and money, because all the projects are done based on some grants received from industry, from the government. So it is required to avoid wasting that by repeating work done by the others. So we need to spend more time and effort finding the holes, whether they are big or small. The bigger the hole we find, the more challenging it will be to close that, and the more interesting will be the solution to be developed in order to handle that challenge. So a researcher or a student should never underestimate his or her skills and potential. So he or she should never think that I will not be able to tackle this because big names did not, or this was not done by them. Or what I see as interesting problem may be of low impact because it is not tackled by big names. So I should not underestimate my potential. My students should not underestimate their potential by looking at big names and say that, oh, these big names have not tried this, means this is not important. So it's important to understand that what made actually these big names big is their ability to see what others could not see and to do what others could not do. So to be a big name, you have to see what others could not see, what others could not do, and try to do those things. So, and without this, it will be not possible to rank high and to receive awards. And this is a big motivation for students. So why to be recognized for repeating what others already did? So it is very important to find the best student or researcher for a given problem. So students have different capabilities and the skills, and understanding the student and their expectations and level of commitment is very crucial for their success and for their successful involvement in the research and the development. So trusting the other parties involved in a common project, whether students or collaborators, is very important for the success, because we have to complement each other in order to achieve the success. So everyone involved in the project is expected to have some potential to contribute. And the level of contribution depends on the capabilities of the person and his or her understanding of the tasks expected, as well as his or her communication skills, because it's very important to communicate with the others in the best way, not to get into conflict, rather than resolve the conflict and try to move the project smoothly forward. So working on improving these skills and helping the researcher or the student to develop and advance his skills or understanding will be highly important to benefit from him or her in future projects with less effort.
Again, Retta, you are, you know, so cognizant of all the available resources out there to help students, to help faculty, to help research, to help with things like the Imagine Cup. So from your perspective, what are the best online resources to use?
Oh, the best online resources. As I said before, digital libraries are very, very helpful and save time and effort. In the past, we were going to the actual physical library and search the periodicals, the books, and others. Now, everything is available online, so digital libraries, ACM, IEEE, Springer, and others are providing wonderful information. I can access from my home, from my office, wherever. While I'm traveling, even I can access them and download whatever I want. So websites of other universities are also very important because there are key developments going on at other universities, and these have to be watched out, and I can download some other papers available as technical reports at other universities' websites. I can download some code developed as open source and shared with the community. Actually, Google is providing very wonderful website where I can search for some documents I am looking for. I can search for other scholars. Microsoft is providing wonderful facilities. So all these are very helpful. So, and even you can read newspapers online. All newspapers are available free of charge online. You can read, you can download, and this helps us also in our research. For example, we analyze magazine articles in order to find out what's going on around, so that how this will influence the research outcome. For example, if we are analyzing stock market, we try to find what external factors are affecting the stock market. Like, is there conflict within the government? They are not getting to agreement on certain economical situations, so that this may reflect directly in the stock market prices, on the forex prices. So we are trying to analyze some articles related to open source intelligence and so on and so forth. So all these resources are very helpful and have been very useful. Though I work on social network analysis, I don't subscribe to any social networking platform, which is something strange, but I don't want to be watched, because everybody connected on these social media platforms is watched by somebody else, and whatever you post on there will remain there whether you remove it or you don't remove it. You cannot say, I did a mistake and post this. So, and even I don't have time to spend on social media. I try to concentrate on whatever is important for the research, the students, for my family. So I have to closely watch my students and spare some time, even minimal time, for my family. Here I cannot pass without thanking my wife, who is really taking care of the kids all the time. It is even more than full-time job for her.
You know, it's interesting. You talked about analyzing digital libraries, available material in the media, newspapers, magazines, and so on. And you talked about stock markets and looking at what's happening in that sort of particular segment. I imagine you look at simulations and so on. Have you actually looked at some of the work of Gabriel Wehner at Carleton at all in simulations?
Yes, but we are trying to tackle this from a different perspective. We try to avoid simulation as per se. We try to develop models that are able to predict and discover knowledge within the data, then simulate the existing technique. So our work is mostly trying to look at the history, analyze the history, build a model from the history, and try to put this model in practice and try to see how this practical model will be successful in analyzing the future and predicting the future. So we try to keep an eye on our system, how it predicts the future, how it is successful, and then we try to adapt when the accuracy of our system goes down with time, because we look, let's say, 10 years back in the history and build the model, and we can maybe predict the next couple days, couple weeks, couple months with high accuracy, and as we go in the future, the trend may change and the accuracy may decrease. So we have to reflect this change in the trend in the system, because when we look at the 10 years back data and we build our system, we try to absorb from the data what is the trend over the past 10 years, and we assume that this trend will continue in the future, and we build our predictions based on that idea that the trend will continue the same in the future. But external factors, as I said, like earthquake, war happening somewhere, some conflict that may happen between different countries, and so on and so forth, may affect the trend in a negative way. So we try to integrate all these into our findings and discoveries so that we can predict with higher accuracy.
Well, again, that's fascinating. I'm still thinking that Judea Pearl's recent work would help in what you're trying to do. Now, on this next question, what special technical tips can you provide when developing apps for things like the Imagine Cup?
Oh, so this is actually an interesting question, because as we are trying to develop some challenging techniques, we have to start as early as possible, as the competition is tough and considerable time is expected to be invested to think even of making it to the final within Canada. So if you want to pass the elimination within Canada, as I said, there were over 700 teams in the initial competition, and only three were selected to the finals. So if we want to make it to the finals, we have to think in the best way possible, start as early as possible. So we have to form a team of students who can work together easily, and their skills do complement each other and sum up into the whole set of skills expected for successful completion of the project. Don't try, as there is no time to try. So let's say I don't want to try putting some students together as a team, and then I find out that one of them is not fitting and replace it. So I should try to find the best students to complement each other and never try. So I want to make sure that all team members are committed and will take the task seriously, because replacing, as I said, any team member at a later stage will be a big risk. Students must work together in strong coordination so that they move forward with similar speed. In order to be successful, I should start thinking at high level and thinking in competing with the successful stories from the past. So I should look at the winning projects from the previous years and try to understand why they were winning teams in such a challenging competition. I should try to compete with them and do something that will have the potential to win in case I were to compete with them. So if I were in the previous years and I wanted to compete in the previous years, so what would have been a good project that would have put me in this top list or on the top of this top list? So thinking in that way will make me produce a good team, good product that will qualify at least for the finals and compete to be one of the best in the finals, because always good teams are good all the time. So if I compete with the previous teams, which were finalists and which win the finals, I will be able to do the best I can do. And it's important to use Microsoft technology and try to be as simple as possible. And I should try to use equipment that has the lowest cost, because people don't want to see the development of products that are very costly. So it is important to have a visible business plan, and use expensive equipment will not be favored by any of the developers. So I should have it as simple as possible, as good as possible, with the minimum cost possible, which are all challenging targets.
So from your perspective then, what do you see as the major challenges your students encounter in their projects, and how do they overcome these challenges?
Oh, deciding on the specific projects that are anticipated to be winning projects was a major challenge, because we had many novel ideas, and it was risky to go for one or two of them. Students who were in favor of certain ideas were hesitating whether to put their effort and push hard for their ideas to be taken, as they don't want to be blamed at the end in case we don't receive the award. So students were having very wonderful ideas, and we were negotiating which idea is the best to go for. From the beginning, I made it clear to all my students that you must express what you have, and it is at the end a group decision, and we are all responsible for the outcome. No single member is responsible. We are working as a team, and we must succeed as a team. We will decide as a team on the scope and coverage of each project and a group responsibility. It is never individual responsibility. This made everyone relax, and all of them were expressing their ideas and thoughts the best way they could. And the next thing is finding the tools appropriate for the project. So we were looking around and trying to find what is the lowest cost, best working tools that we can use. And thanks to Microsoft providing Kinect at very minimal cost, and many of their software tools were very helpful. So, and the time to complete the work, as we have too many things to be done in limited time, so we have to manage our time. And for that, sometimes my students did not find time even to sleep, because they have to complete certain tasks in limited amount of time, and we have to decide on the priorities, what we can do and what we should do and what we cannot do and what we should avoid doing, because we have to get at least a working system with minimal functionalities and build on that instead of trying to build the whole system at once and fail. So we build a very simple system as a proof of the idea, and we prove that our concepts are good and working, and then we start to incrementally build on top of the working system so that we can stop at any stage and have a running system that will be good enough to compete with the other. So, but we are happy that we were able to achieve too many things. And the other thing that I was looking for in my students, diversity of knowledge, because we need to put together different ideas from different perspectives, and the diversity of our knowledge allows us to tackle a variety of applications and domains, and this was one of the key points to success. So actually, sometimes we feel that we have promised more than what we can complete within the time frame, because the students get excited and they say, oh, we can do this, we can do that. I get to wonder whether the available resources are enough to do whatever they are promising, but I leave them to promise, so that I don't want to put them down or to disappoint them, so I let them to work. And fortunately, my students spent time and great effort to catch up and succeed, and they never give up, and they always look forward to the success, and this makes them achieve the target and win the award.
Now, what special developer techniques do your students use in their innovations?
My students distinguish themselves by their diverse knowledge, as I said, yet they are deep in various aspects. They know a wide number of techniques that they can put together to produce hybrid solutions. This capability makes my students unique compared to many other students who focus on a specific aspect and end up thinking locally rather than globally. So I insist on my students to think on global solutions, not to think of local solutions for specific target, for specific thing. So try to test from a wider perspective so that they can locate all the flows and handle them instead of leaving them to later stage. So spend more time on the development and on understanding the weaknesses and overcome them. So my students try to integrate data mining, machine learning, network analysis techniques into the development of their system. This combination turned the outcome into a solid system with comprehensive coverage. The students will investigate the Microsoft Kinect and follow the latest development announced by Microsoft. Even they changed the newer version of the Kinect after the Canadian finals, because until the Canadian finals, we were using the older version of Kinect. Then after Canadian finals, we realized that Microsoft announced the new Kinect, and we had to use the new Kinect, and that required more effort to adapt to the new technology, because it has many functionalities that are new, and this required my students to re-implement some parts of the system in short time, which was amazing, and they get to the finals with a system which was almost 60 or 70% improved over the one that was presented at the Canadian finals. This made us happy, and we went to the finals with more self-confidence.
You know, throughout this discussion, we've been talking about the Imagine Cup, and we also talk about, or it's implied, all the different kinds of Microsoft technologies are using. So what are your recommended Microsoft technologies and why?
Oh, Windows 8 is amazing, actually. It is a new trend, which is easy to use and very user-friendly. And the HTC phone has been very helpful for us because we developed a mobile-based version of Sano so that the users can watch their health indicators on their mobile phone, and the mobile phone will warn them in order to keep healthy and fit. And the Kinect is wonderful with the one combined actually with the Xbox. My kids love them because they play games all that day using Xbox and Kinect. So, and I'm happy that my kids at home are using Kinect and my students in the lab are using Kinect to develop their software for the Microsoft Imagine Cup. So I can have both my students and my kids using the Microsoft technology.
Right, we're down to our last series of questions, and this one is outside of technology and a specific technology. It's more of a broader global question. You know, we have professions like medicine, accounting, and law, which have been around for, in some cases, for centuries. And then we have this upstart called computing. So do you feel computing should be a recognized profession on par with the others, like accounting, medicine, and law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credential?
Oh, this is a very interesting question. Yes, I think it must be, but unfortunately, looks like more time is still needed to realize this because other professions have been around for a long time, and I guess since the beginning they were set with their own rules, ethics, responsibilities, and so on. So you cannot imagine a medical doctor who does not have a degree in medicine and practicing. But we can see around many computing specialists who claim computing specialists and they don't have degrees. But I am not sure how long it will take in order to have this as a profession by itself with some rules and regulations. So, but I think that we are moving forward slowly, though we are in very better shape than the 80s and 90s. As I said, in the past there was a big debate to define what is computer science and who could be classified as computer scientist. So it is very common to find someone with that computing degree working in the field of computing. And as I said, this is not common in other disciplines because they all were well-set professions, and this might be due to the huge need for skilled workers with expertise in computing because computer science started to be realized more in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and there were not many graduates from the universities, and they were needing the market, so people were looking for a job, and they were trying to build their own skills, maybe. People were developing minimal skills, even on their own, and were even welcomed as acceptable employees, because people were needing them as employees to develop some computing techniques. This uncontrolled involvement in the field of computing badly reflected on the development of algorithms and systems that are not well functioning, and this affected the overall automation process. We are still suffering, actually, from badly developed software systems and from the lack of documentation that would have allowed for the maintenance and development of advanced versions of existing systems. Many systems are being redeveloped from scratch because they were badly developed in the past. There is no documentation. This was realized actually in the 90s. And if we look at the research in the 90s, there has been a huge amount of research on system reengineering in order to understand the characteristics of systems and redevelop them rather than going from scratch development because it's very costly. So if we succeed in developing computing as a profession with well set boundaries, requirements, expectations and responsibilities, accountabilities, ethics, then it will be possible to produce more sophisticated outcome, which is hardly needed in this era of rapidly growing technology and data collection. So we have to have more sophisticated systems to analyze the big data that is being collected. We have to have more well-developed techniques with solid background. So we have to have this computing as a profession, but I don't know how long it will take in order to get there, but we are moving in that direction.
You know, I sort of concur that it'll take time because computing is such a young profession, but it's interesting that there are trends worldwide where there is movement in this direction, including the ITU moving in this direction, UNESCO putting out efforts to sort of codify ethics in some way, and various other organizations around the world, who like IFIP IP3, also in support of professionalizing computing. And I guess I'm reminded of what's been in the news in the U.S., this healthcare.gov, and maybe those kinds of challenges that have occurred with that web portal would not have occurred if we had maybe some, you know, a greater degree of professionalization of computing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you are right. I agree.
Well, we're down to our last couple of questions, and Aretta, you do travel extensively because you're in such demand because of your renowned expertise and just the tremendous amount of success that you've had, but also your students. So from all of your speaking, travels, and work, do you have any interesting stories to share, maybe something amusing, unexpected, surprising, and so on?
Oh, let me start by describing some old stuff and then move to some more recent stuff. Let me start with my PhD. I did an excellent PhD project, let's say, by working on query models for object-oriented databases. Object-oriented databases were booming and highly attractive in the late 80s and 90s. Everybody was trying to work on object-oriented databases because they realized that existing technology at that time was not powerful enough to handle new applications. So everyone was thinking that object-oriented databases would be the best solution. But they were working on developing systems before they developed the theory underneath the object-oriented databases, which is a different trend than relational databases, because in relational databases, it was built on a solid theory of math, which made relational databases wonderful and acceptable in the market and in the academia. Then in the late 90s, most of the characteristics of object-oriented databases were absorbed by relational databases, and we get the object-relational databases. So I completed my coursework and PhD project in 29 months, which was a record at that time. And the quality of my work was well recognized by the research community, and I was so delighted and happy to be invited as speaker at the NATO Advanced Study Institute Summer School on Object-Oriented Databases in summer 1993, only a few months following my defense in February 1993. Actually, I was the only speaker who was fresh graduate. All other speakers were well-established professors, well-known big name, and I was the only fresh graduate because of the importance of my achievement on query models for object-oriented databases. They invited me to speak about that at the school and share my experience with other graduate students attending the school. And I was one of 12 speaker, and the book that was produced from the summer school included one chapter per lecture, and that book remained the main textbook for graduate courses in object-oriented databases in North America, Europe, all over, until they become less attractive, as I said, in the late 90s, and then they disappeared. And the next thing I would like to talk about is coming to Canada was an interesting experience. I never thought actually of moving to North America, even for graduate study. When I completed my undergrad at Middle East Technical University in Turkey, I get a wonderful offer from Pilkent University to continue my graduate studies in an environment which is at least as good as the top universities in North America. They were very promising, and they had high expectations, and they were trying to attract the top students graduating from other Turkish universities in order to build a real North American university in the Middle East. So, and I joined Pilkent University. I'm happy that I joined, and I graduated with PhD from there, and I did excellent work. As I said, I was invited to the NATO Advanced Study Institute Summer School in Object-Oriented Databases. And in March 2001, I was attending a conference in Las Vegas when I met Ken Barker from Calgary. He was at that time in Calgary. He moved from Manitoba, and he was planning to be the head of the department, trying to build a strong group. So he offered me to apply and come to Calgary. And by chance, during that year, I decided to move to work in North America based on strong recommendations from a close friend that I'm still young. I have to go and get North American experience. And already I had applied by that time to some other universities in North America, and I had get some offers from U.S. and Canada. So when Ken encouraged me to come to Calgary, I met some other Turkish friends who are common friends with Ken, and they also advised me to keep Calgary as my first choice, regardless of other considerations. So I had hard time finalizing a decision with several offers. Then my wife and I decided on Calgary. We are happy and think we took the right decision. One of the U.S. employers actually called me afterwards and asked me, can you tell what made you choose Calgary so that we take that into consideration in the future search and offer? And the last thing I want to talk about is my trip from Australia in 2011. I was traveling back from a conference, and it was winter time in Canada, and of course it was summertime in Australia. So almost midway, we got into turbulence, and the aircraft was shaking badly, actually. The worst I have ever seen and experienced in 25 years flying. I thought we will not make it. And the pilot said on the mic, don't worry, we have experienced worse than this. So that made me relax a little and less anxious. So, and finally we landed in Vancouver, and I was happy. So
I'm just thinking, is Mike Williams from the university there in Calgary?
Yeah, Mike Williams, he's at the University of Calgary. He retired a couple of years ago, and he is, I guess, emeritus now.
Yeah, I bring it up because, he would be emeritus at this point, and he's a KIPPS fellow, so I'm a fellow of KIPPS as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely has a remarkable background for sure. Now, we're down to our last question. If you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask in that? What would be your answer? So I'm kind of turning the tables.
Oh, okay. So the first question I may ask is why you decided to work in the academia? And my answer would be, I like teaching and research because I like to teach students how to be innovative and how to develop their own skills and how to think outside the box. I was teaching at King Saud University, for example, in Saudi Arabia a long time ago. When I graduated with PhD, I worked there for 3 years. One of the students attending my classes said, Professor, you know, you are enlightening some dark parts in our mind, which made me happy that I am passing the message to the students the right way. So I get delighted when I see my students excel and when I see them well benefiting from the knowledge I deliver in the classroom. 2 weeks ago, one of my PhD students got hired by Google, by Oracle, another one got hired by Google, but the one who was hired by Oracle, she told me, Professor, you know, most of the questions that appeared in the interview were tackled in your courses, in your classes, and based on the knowledge I get in your courses, I was able to answer all the questions and I get the job. This made me happy. So the second question I would have asked, if you were not to work in the academia, what other profession would you have chosen? My answer for this question would be again the academia, because I cannot think of myself doing something else other than working in the academia, because I enjoy my work doing research and teaching. Both are things that I like and I will enjoy doing for a long time. For example, many of my friends ask me whether I want to be head of department, dean, or something else. I always refuse to take administrative position because I want to be with the students, work on research, teaching them, and this is what I like and what I want to do. The other question I would have asked, given my heavy load, how I can divide my time between my family and my research. Here, my answer would be, I would like again to thank my wife for being so understanding the situation and for accepting to carry part of the load. She is taking care of the family and I'm taking care of the students. And many times my kids meet with my students and they have nice time together. So they are like one family together and we enjoy all the time that I work with my students when it is needed to work with the students. My wife takes care of the kids when it is necessary to take care of the kids. When I have heavy load or I am traveling, sometimes I travel for 1 month to meet some collaborators in the other side of the country, of the world overseas. And this has been a very wonderful experience sharing this with my wife to run the family and the group successfully.
Retta, those are very good questions and very insightful answers, and you've taken us on a remarkable journey. And I know your schedule is very demanding and tight, and yet you were able to spend this time to share many of your deep global and national experiences with us, and we really do appreciate you coming in today to do this interview.
Oh, thank you, Stephen, for the interview. It was indeed an interesting conversation. I hope the content will be helpful and useful for the audience.
Definitely. There's many nuggets in this interview, useful information that will help millions worldwide. So again, thank you so much. And in closing, I'm going to say I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Retta Alhaj, global top scientist who has shared many of his deep insights and special tips with our audience.